Gaza, Palestinians who are, you know, currently displaced and who've also suffered injuries and loss of relatives. And in our motion for preliminary injunction, we essentially tell the court, unless the court intervenes now and issues an urgent, some urgent relief, the harm to these people, these Palestinians, will be so irreparable. And so we need some urgent action pending the sort of resolution of the litigation, which always, of course, takes much longer time. And so the hearing, the government filed a motion to dismiss as well as an opposition to, you know, our motion seeking that urgent relief. And we had that hearing on Friday, which you were just describing, a really remarkable hearing in many ways. I think in large part, you know, one of the most remarkable aspects was, as far as I can tell, as far as I'm aware of, we've been, you know, litigating Palestine related cases and just been a student of them for decades. And I can't think of another time where in a U.S. federal court, Palestinians have been on the witness stand one after the other, describing, you know, their experiences under Israeli occupation uninterrupted, in a way that offers a holistic, complete, and complicated accounting of what has been happening to Palestinians. And in this case, not just over the course of the last 16 weeks since the latest assault and this unfolding genocide started, but really kind of placing it in a broader context, every single one of our plaintiffs got up there. And in order to explain the impact to the court, to the judge, of the current moment and Israeli calls for Nakba now, had to explain the history of the Nakba. I've never heard the word Nakba be said in federal court so many times. And it was an important part of their telling because they were there to, they were tasked with, you know, describing the urgency and the harm and the injury that they are experiencing. And it is, of course, a multi-layered harm. And in order to explain how they even got to Gaza in the first place, they have to explain their family's history as a refugee population, the fragmentation of Palestinians. So there was so much that was really remarkable about the hearing, but that really stands out to me as one of the major aspects.
And Yala, if you can quickly say, how did the preliminary judgment of the International Court of Justice in The Hague weigh in and inform the case that you brought? Because it happened right after on Friday, as they said, Israel has to prevent a genocide in Gaza. And also the significance of the judge saying this is the most difficult case he'll ever have to decide.
Yeah, so as you said, mere hours after the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, issued its order, we, you know, it was 4 a.m. California time. Our hearing started at 9 a.m. We reviewed it as fast as we could, submitted it to the court because it was, of course, relevant and hadn't really had the time to fully process it. But walking into that hearing with the sort of validation in many ways, although we all, I think, knew exactly, in some ways we didn't need the validation, but that the international court, that the world court had found that there was, you know, a plausible case of genocide that required the order that it issued with the provisional measures was significant. The judge took note of it. And in many ways, we're in similar postures in our federal court proceeding as that International Court of Justice proceeding, which is the provisional measures at the international court level also just sought to get these urgent provisional measures at a showing of plausibility. So we don't have time to have the full litigation on the merits, because it, by the time we come around, the damage will be done and there will be nobody left to save. And so that's why we got that order from the ICJ. And we're making the similar arguments to the court here. We just need these this preliminary injunction now, and then we can litigate this
I want to bring in Leila El Haddad. You're a Palestinian writer and journalist from Gaza. You are the co-editor of a book with Rafat El Arir, who was killed in Gaza only recently, well-known, acclaimed writer and academic in Gaza. You are the author of Gaza Mom, Palestine Politics, Parenting, and Everything in Between, speaking to us, though, from near Baltimore today. What did you testify in court on Friday, Leila?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Amy. I and other plaintiffs who spoke in a personal capacity, not the organizational plaintiffs, about how this ongoing genocide and particularly U.S. complicity in it has impacted our families in Gaza and, of course, our families here as well. So I started off by introducing myself. Excuse me. As you can see, it's been a long weekend. My voice is completely gone. I spoke about my family both in Gaza City and in the south of Gaza in Khan Yunis. And I started off by talking about how Israel had killed multitudes of them on my mother's side. I believe the number is now 86. And five of my immediate family members in Gaza City and had displaced the rest of them to multiple location and how Israel was responsible for starving them and depriving them of basic human needs and so on, all with active U.S. support, with U.S. weapons and with U.S. financial support and with U.S. diplomatic support. I spoke about my aunt and my adult cousins and my cousin's wife in Gaza City. I had finally had a chance after 3 months to get the full details from the surviving brother, who is now, I mean, even his whereabouts now are unknown after a heavy night of Israeli bombardment on Gaza City. But he was telling me how he had to, on his own, retrieve his sister's body parts, half of his mother, because he couldn't retrieve the other half, how he had to bury them himself with his own hands in a mass grave, how his sister's body, my cousin, was still unaccounted for under the rubble, and how he himself was severely injured, and how his brother, my other cousin, bled to death because he couldn't even access medical care. They couldn't get paramedics to the area. So it was very heavy and very painful, but also very urgent. And that was part of the point, is to speak about how we have not had the luxury as Palestinians, and particularly Palestinians from Gaza, to grieve. We have not had that luxury. And we recognize how being Palestinians in America necessitates our involvement in this case, how it obligates us to do everything we can to take every possible recourse, including legal recourse, to try and put an end to this, since it's our tax dollars who are being put to work and American weaponry, as I said, and so on.
And this latest attack on Khan Yunis, as you have many family members, there are so many of the people now who are being told to leave Khan Yunis. They have moved repeatedly, thinking that each next place was a safe zone, now being forced to Rafah, to the border, to the sea. Where are your family members, and what do you hope will come out of this?
They are, without exaggeration, everywhere, like everyone else. And I hate to keep saying that, but I sometimes, not to trivialize, but I feel like you look at someone else and then you say, well, at least their situation's a little better. But truth be told, the entire situation is just beyond description, horrific. And every morning when I, you know, look at my feed and my WhatsApp and communicate with my family members, I try not to ask even, you know, how they're doing, but I know that they derive hope from knowing that we are all doing something here to speak out about what's happening. And that, again, was one of the main motivating factors behind being involved in this lawsuit. But my family, several of them are actually still in Gaza City. They haven't left since the very beginning. I have two direct cousins there, and their husbands and all of their children are, one of them is in front of the Nasser Hospital in Gaza City. The others are in Rimal. My one cousin was in the Shifa compound and then decided to go to another neighborhood in Rimal with his family. I don't even know where, on the street somewhere, because his home was destroyed. My eldest uncle, who's blind and deaf, with his son and family are in central Gaza in Zawaida near the Maghazi refugee camp. And my mother's family were in Khan Yunis, as you mentioned, and then are now in Mawasi. And so I haven't been able to communicate with them for a while. But one of the cousins I was, and her home in Garada was destroyed. And she's now with her four children, literally under a nylon tarp because they couldn't even find a tent. And her husband, who has cancer. And it's a little, I mean, for those who aren't familiar, Mawasi is literally a sandy enclave, almost like sand dunes directly adjacent to the beach. So there's nothing there. Beyond the seawater and whatever tents you might have access to. And now, of course, with aid being cut by several countries, including the United States, which, as it's been said, Blinken did not hesitate within a matter of seconds to shut that aid off. And yet, for more than 3 months, Palestinians have been enduring an ongoing genocide, which the United States not only has refused to stop, but is actively aiding and abetting. And despite overwhelming evidence, including, you know, President Biden himself acknowledging the attacks have been discriminate or some of the bombings have been discriminate, despite overwhelming evidence about, despite the intent and by stated intent by Israeli leaders that there are no innocents in Gaza, that this was intended to make Gaza unlivable, Layla, still has not ended that.
We're going to talk about that cutting off of aid to UNRWA in our next segment. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Layla Ahdad, Palestinian writer-journalist from Gaza, and Yella Shemes, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Next up, we speak to an emergency room physician just back from Khan Yunis and with the head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland. Norway is saying it will not cut off aid to UNRWA, despite the fact U.S. and 12 other countries are doing so. Stay with us.
In the saddest thing, under the sun above, is to say goodbye to the ones you
Saddest Thing by Melanie Safka. The folk singer rose to fame from Woodstock 1969, died last week at the age of 76. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to conditions in southern Gaza's Khan Yunis area, where displaced Palestinians who fled there to seek refuge are reporting heavy aerial and tank fire as Israel intensifies its ground offensive around two main hospitals there. We're joined in Chicago by Dr. Thayer Ahmoud, an emergency room physician just back after spending 3 weeks in Gaza, volunteering at Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, board member for Med Global, which has an office in Gaza, is working with the World Health Organization. Dr. Ahmed just returned to Chicago Thursday, where he's the global health director of his hospital, also an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Dr. Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us what you experienced in Khan Yunis at the hospital.
Hospitals that has surgical capabilities. You have thousands of people sheltering inside of the hospital, families sheltering right around the hospital in the area of the medical complex. And what I saw was relentless bombing that was taking place day and night. You saw many people who were injured, many of whom were children. Many were of people who were just trying to go about their regular day, looking for where their next meal would come from, looking for where they could attain water. And in the process of doing so, they were hit by tank shells or by airstrikes or by sniper fire. It was really horrific and overwhelming. I mean, I work at a level one trauma center in Chicago, and the south side of Chicago is no stranger to trauma or to gang violence. This was something that was on a level that I don't think many people in America have ever experienced. Every aspect of life in Gaza has been affected, has been disrupted, has been made harder. And you really felt that while you were in the hospital. The physicians that I was working alongside have been working nonstop for nearly 4 months. They also are hungry. They also are concerned about where they can get clean water from. Their families have been displaced multiple times. And they're being asked to take care of waves and waves of people who are coming in as victims of bomb strikes or tank shellings. You saw children walking around the complex barefoot. They looked like they were hungry, looking for food. They were trying to just find some sort of refuge. They're not going to school. They're not getting vaccinated. They're not going to their regular appointments. And what we saw on the nights when it was really intensifying is a mass migration of people. I remember looking outside of the hospital window and seeing a four-year-old girl holding onto her pillow and her dad hurriedly trying to grab whatever he could, and they were going to flee on foot further south. Probably would have to walk 5 or 6 miles in the middle of the night, 3 or 4 a.m., as you heard F-16s above head and the relentless bombing taking place. And I thought, this can't be real. This is not something that I would expect in 2024, something to be happening. And I think that part of what we're seeing is, that these people are consistently being dehumanized and re-traumatized. So it's very simple to just say people are being asked to evacuate. People are being asked to go to a safer place. But what I realized very quickly and what the doctors in Gaza told me is that there is no place in Gaza that's safe. There's nowhere that you can take refuge. No place has been spared from bombing. And just because there might be an intense military campaign taking place in Khan Yunis like there was, it doesn't mean that Rafah, which is further south, would be any safer and wouldn't be subject to any sort of bombing. And that the people in the north of Gaza were also suffering immensely. I mean, I was there in the midst of a 8-day telecommunications blackout. And I remember the doctors there who were asked to work these 24-hour shifts thinking about their families and not knowing what was going to take place, or not knowing if they were okay, not knowing if they had eaten for the day. And so that's something that I think was really traumatizing to experience secondhand. And I was only there for less than 3 weeks. This is what they've had to deal with for 4 months.
Reports are from the UN. At least 300 healthcare workers have been killed in Gaza. Also, Al Jazeera, speaking to a doctor at Nasser Hospital, where you were, Dr. Ahmed, in Khan Yunis, said 95% of staff fled to Rafah as Israeli forces, quote, bomb anything in front of them. So how many people are taking refuge in Nasser in addition to the wounded? How many dead bodies are piling up? And how many medical staff are left?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that was noticeably thinning every single day that the military assault was taking place in Khan Yunis, that more and more staff had to leave the hospital to go take care of their families and make sure their families were safe. You can say that there was probably two dozen in terms of medical staff and doctors as well as nurses. I just want to point out that none of these physicians or nurses have been paid also for the last 4 months. They received one payment of $200 in November. They otherwise are volunteering, essentially, and just trying to serve their people. And in the process of that, as you mentioned, many of them have been subjected to violence, have been killed. Many have been arrested as well. And so that was one of the concerns, that when we were in Khan Yunis and there was some serious, intense bombing taking place, is you saw that there was this sort of tension that existed. And I remember trying to say, you know, I think the hospital should be safe. And they very quickly said, what would make you think that a Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis is any different than Shifa in Gaza City, or Al Andunisi hospital, or any of the other hospitals that have been attacked? What happens is, while these attacks are taking place, as you mentioned, people who have been killed, their bodies are left in the street. And it's very dangerous for any sort of first responder to be able to go and try to retrieve the body or to try to bring somebody who's wounded. So many people may die in the process. And so you see healthcare workers digging mass graves to be able to bury some of the wounded there. And there are thousands of people sheltering in the hospital. Amy, if you were to walk in Nasser Hospital, to go to any floor, you see people in every inch and every corner. They may have this small, thin mattress or a blanket over them, families congregating together because they assume that the hospital can be a sanctuary. And time again, that has been proven incorrect in Gaza. And so again, people have no choice. They have nowhere left to go. And the hospital staff are overworked. And I understand that there's this notion that, you know, the people of Gaza are different. And I experienced that. They are so resilient and they are so impressive from every single corners or every single angle. They're able to do so much with so little resources, and they are phenomenal physicians and healthcare workers. But why are we insisting that we keep pushing them to their limit, to the maximum limit? Why do we keep trying to test their superhuman capabilities? That's something that I found really disturbing while I was there.
Dr. Thera Ahmed, we're going to ask you to stay after the show. We're going to continue our conversation with your eyewitness report on the ground in Gaza, now just back in Chicago, emergency room physician, volunteered at Al-Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian officials and human rights groups are denouncing the move by the United States and at least 12 other countries to temporarily suspend funding to UNRWA. That's the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, after Israel accused 12 UNRWA employees of helping Hamas stage the October 7th attack. Nine of the employees have been fired. UNRWA said two of the accused employees are dead. UNRWA is one of the largest employers in Gaza, with a staff of over 13,000. It provides aid to most of Gaza's 2.3 million residents. The agency's long been targeted by Israel. Since Israel's assault on Gaza began, over 150 UNRWA staffers have been killed. Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, said on social media, quote, "The day after ICJ concluded that Israel's plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, some states decide to defund UNRWA, collectively punishing millions of Palestinians at the most critical time and most likely violating their obligations under the Genocide Convention," unquote. Meanwhile, UNRWA chief Philippe Lazzarini condemned the freezing of the funds at a time when famine looms in Gaza. He said, quote, "Palestinians in Gaza did not need the additional collective punishment. This stains all of us," he said. And the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has urged donor nations to continue supporting UNRWA. For more, we're going to Oslo, Norway, where we're joined by Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Norway's decided to continue its funding of UNRWA. Jan, thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by responding to the cutting off of funding at a time when, among other things, Gaza is under bombardment and is on the edge of famine?
Yeah, it's the worst possible reaction to these allegations that some, I mean, maybe a dozen of the 13,000 UNRWA aid workers betrayed our humanitarian principles of neutrality and independence and participated in the horrific attacks on Israel. That, however, was met immediately with the response of UNRWA by, as you said, firing these staff and now having an independent investigation. What the donors did, the US, the UK, Germany, Italy, Finland, Netherlands, Australia, and some others, did was to cut all aid to the children of Gaza, to the women in Gaza, to the completely innocent there. It's the worst possible move at the time when this trapped population is under bombardment. Do not punish the many innocent for the sins of a few who did very wrong, it seems.
Now, it'll be interesting to see if Israel hands over the evidence for the UN to investigate this situation, because we're talking about an immediate cutoff by many of these nations suspending weapons. I wanted to read you a clip of the former Israeli official Noga Arbel, who said it'll be impossible to win the war if we do not destroy UNRWA, and this destruction must begin immediately. the Prime Minister Netanyahu said there will be no UNRWA in post-war Gaza. Your response, Jan Egeland, and talk about you're the head of a large humanitarian aid group. How important is UNRWA to all of the groups, not to mention the people on the ground?
UNRWA is completely essential. I mean, it's true that I lead the NRC, Norwegian Refugee Council, where large humanitarian group across the world, where on all sides of all conflict lines for the displaced and the refugees. And we've been in Gaza for two decades. We've been funded all over the world by the United States and by 40 other donor nations and international agencies. In Gaza, we have to recognize that all of us combined other groups are not even close to be what UNRWA is for the people of Gaza. UNRWA was a response to the creation of Israel and the 1948 war that displaced so many of the original Palestinian population to Gaza, to the West Bank, and elsewhere. UNRWA was then created to give them relief and works. Since then, there's not been a political peaceful settlement, and that is because the international community has not been able to force the parties, Israel and the Palestinian, to settle this conflict. And thereby, we end up by having humanitarian groups like, first and foremost, UNRWA, provide for the population. So to undermine and undercut UNRWA, as extremists within the Israeli government are doing, is basically to say we're going to punish the women and children, the innocent on the other side, for what some extremists have done in a situation of utter turmoil and perpetuous conflict that we're not ourselves willing to try to settle with talks on a future. It's very wrong, and the international donors must stay with the humanitarian organizations like Norway did. Norway is a large donor, giving much more per capita to Palestinians and elsewhere than any other donor. We stay with UNRWA, and we say, good that you terminated all of those contracts and fired these people, and good that there is an investigation, and then we'll draw the conclusions what we should do for the future.
Jan Egeland, what evidence is there of Israel's charges? Have they handed over the evidence?
As far as I know, it's not been received by UNRWA or by the UN investigators. I hope they will be received so that they can do a thorough investigation of this. Very serious allegations. I read about them in the New York Times. If it's true, again, they betrayed all of our principles, really, neutrality, impartiality, et cetera. That is so important for us who are unarmed humanitarian workers in the crossfire around the world. But, of course, no one who's working across the Middle East can guarantee that there are not people within our midst that may, in the end, have hidden agendas. Palestinians cannot do that. Israeli cannot do that. We know of many Israelis who've done very bad things in Gaza, shooting at people with white flags. It's documented in detail. They've even shot their own people with white flags. They have settler organizations, mafia-style settler organizations, displacing unarmed women and children and families across the West Bank. Many of these are recruited to the Israeli Defense Forces. They belong in jail, but they are in the Israeli Defense Force. No one can guarantee that there are not problems. Therefore, they have to be investigated, and there has to be action taken every time something happens. But don't cut funding to people in great need. It's the worst possible response.
Jan Egeland, I want to thank you for being with us. Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council speaking to us from Oslo. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!
podcast from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss.